Fact, charter schools are boosting student achievement.
So can I enroll, please?
The National Alliance for Public Charter Schools wants you to know the facts. Visit www.publiccharters.org.
Hey, Russell Wilson here, and I know how important exercise is.
It's essential. It's essential.
With Play 60, United Way and the NFL are helping kids stay active and play at least 60 minutes a day.
Healthy kids, healthy kids.
But what this place needs is you. To donate or volunteer, go to unitedway.org/play60 because great things happen when we live united.
Donate, donate.
Are you guys going to do that every time?
Yes, of course. Yes, of course.
Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, this is a world premiere. Go-Go is now on Sirius XM. It's Crank Radio with Shorty Coleon and Rico Anderson. Saturdays and Sundays, 9 to 10, channel 141. HUR Voices. Check in and check out the Crank. Let's Go-Go.
All you want to know about Go-Go is right here on Crank Radio.
There's no party like a Crank Radio party, because a Crank Radio party don't stop.
Hi, this is Rashawn McDonald, the host of MoneyMakingConversation.com. My weekly radio show is about entrepreneurship and entertainment. My goal is to inspire people to accomplish their goals and live their very best life. MoneyMakingConversation.com continues to feature recognizable industry leaders including Don Lemon, Lonnie Love, Dondre Whitfield, Jacob Lattimore, Tika Sumter, Tyler Perry, and Darren DeWitt Henson. Please be sure to tune in every week for new episodes of Money Making Conversations with me, Rashawn McDonald, on Sirius XM 141, HUR Voices.
Do you need expert advice from successful business leaders on how to start, grow, and finance your business? Tune in every Thursday to the Small Business Report on Sirius XM Channel 141 HUR Voices with your hosts Carl Brown and Sharon Morton. Carl and Sharon will talk to experts around the country, giving you the advice you need to start and grow a successful business. The Small Business Report, giving you the tools you need to succeed. Thursday at 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Sirius XM Channel 141, HUR Voices.
COVID-19 has changed everything for the children of the world. Since the earliest days of the pandemic, we've been on the ground providing children food, educational resources, and basics no child should be without. To learn more, visit savethechildren.org/together. This holiday season, join us and make change for children. Visit savethechildren.org/together. Furnished by Save the Children.
Howard University was founded in 1867 in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Howard University prides itself in a tradition of quality education. Whatever your particular interest, Howard University will provide you with numerous resources to excel. Howard University has an illustrious network of alumni that span the country and the global community. For more information on Howard University, log on to www.howard.edu.
Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues, 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. He is one of the greatest figures in Black history. Frederick Douglass, orator, abolitionist, statesman, and so much more, getting a unique treatment this week on HBO.
My friends, I've come to tell you something about slavery.
Our newspapers are daily disfigured by its ghastly horrors.
Imagine that you had to dispel doubts about your full humanity every time you picked up a pen. Having to fight that battle over and over every day. That was the life of Frederick Douglass.
I feel that I have a right to speak and to speak strongly.
We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake.
More than 20 years of my life were consumed in a state of slavery. I feel bound to speak truly.
He had a gift as a storyteller, and he had an unforgettable voice. Stop telling them they can't fight, and tell them they can't fight.
It became an American phenomenon to see Douglass.
Overthrow this system of slavery, which is crushing them to the earth!
Woo! Frederick Douglass in 5 speeches airs this Wednesday on HBO. And joining us to talk about it tonight is Kenneth B. Morris Jr., a direct descendant of Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington, and founder of the Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives. Lines are open for this Black History conversation at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisher, WHUR, or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Mr. Morris, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Thank you very much for having me on.
I got goosebumps just watching the trailer earlier today. I'm sure you felt the same.
Yes, absolutely. You know, anytime there's an opportunity to be able to talk about the life of my great ancestor, Frederick Douglass, as we do in this HBO documentary on Wednesday, it's just something that gives me goosebumps. You know, we don't have any recorded voice of Frederick Douglass. The only description that we have are articles that describe, you know, what he looked like, what his mannerisms were like, what he wore, and what his voice sounded like, which was a booming baritone voice. But to actually hear these outstanding actors read his words, it's something that gives me goosebumps as well.
Let's talk about that for a moment. Let's dissect this documentary, because there are great voices in it, Jeffrey Wright among them. Talk to me about the voices that we will hear that will tell this unique story about one of the greatest individuals, not only in Black history, but world history.
The film traces the life of my great ancestor and the history of 19th century America through five of his legendary speeches performed by five of the most talented Black actors working today. The documentary was inspired by David Blight's Pulitzer Prize-winning biography, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, and it was executive produced by scholar Henry Louis Gates, Jr. So the acclaimed actors are Nicole Beharie, Coleman Domingo, Jonathan Majors, Denzel Whitaker, and, as you mentioned, the great Jeffrey Wright, who performs the last speech, which is called Lessons of the Hour, and Frederick Douglass delivered it in 1893, just 2 years before he passed away. And in that final speech, it was written at the fall of Reconstruction, and he was lamenting the rise of lynching across the United States. And he had really been spurred back into activism in his later years by his young friend Ida B. Wells, who was a mentee of his.
Mm-hmm. How did you first come to be a part of this, beyond the obvious? What was that call like? What was the letter or email like? How did this come to you?
I got an email the first part of last year. And so, of course, we were locked down with COVID at that time, and I wasn't doing much traveling. And it came from the producer, director of the documentary, and she just reached out to tell me about it. I was referred to her by David Blight, who actually sits on our board for the Frederick Douglass Family Initiative, and we just had a conversation about what they wanted to do with this, and you know, it just kind of evolved. And then I think I actually filmed my part of it sometime during the summer out here in Southern California, where I live. So it was really just a great process to work with the team and to see, you know, what has come from this. And the audiences are going to be amazed and just really inspired when they see this documentary. Mm-hmm.
You obviously are familiar with the five speeches. Can you take us through this process? Because as you said, we don't have recordings of Frederick Douglass, just descriptions. There are plenty of photographs, and here recently we've actually seen, I know I've seen, a chronology of sorts of some of his youngest photographs, all the way up to the photographs where he is
you know, full bearded and full haired and the whole bit. And just to watch that chronology of life almost makes you feel as if you know him. But what new might a viewer get from these speeches? Take us through that.
Yeah, before I jump into that, I just wanted to just comment on what you were talking about with his photography. He was the most photographed American of the 19th century. He was photographed more than President Lincoln, Ulysses S. Grant, General Custer. And I worked on a book in 2015 called Picturing Frederick Douglass, where we made the case that he was the most photographed American. And we published 168 photographs, which really spanned his 50-plus public year career. The last photo of him was taken the day after he passed away, which was his deathbed photo. And so he understood that he could use this new technology, photography, to make his arguments for liberation and equality in addition to his oratory and his writings. And he was very strategic about the way he presented himself in the public sphere to really just combat that notion that was out there that people of African descent were not worthy of freedom, not worthy of citizenship. And he said, when you look at a photograph of me, you're going to see my humanity, and you'll never deny that I'm a man worthy of citizenship, and I never want to look like a happy, amiable fugitive slave. So that's why you always see him with that fiery, steely glare that he's looking directly into the camera. But there are the five speeches. The first one is called I've Come to Tell You Something About Slavery, and he delivered it in 1841. It's read by Denzel Whitaker, and this would have been just 3 years after he escaped slavery in 1838, and he gives a speech about what it was like to be enslaved. He had been hired by the anti-slavery society, William Lloyd Garrison, the white abolitionist, and the Garrisonians heard his story, and they understood that they had a star really on their hands, and he was able to really communicate the inhumanity of slavery and the injustices and the brutality that he had suffered, endured, and survived in a way nobody before him had ever done. And it's really a powerful speech. The second speech is Country, Conscience, and the Anti-Slavery Cause, which was delivered in 1847. He would have just returned back from a tour of Europe after the publication of his first autobiography, The Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave, that was published in 1845. It became a bestseller, and the notoriety of that book threatened his freedom, so he would have to flee to Europe for a couple of years. He would land in this place called Newcastle upon Tyne, and with the help of his abolitionist friends, they did a fundraiser and purchased his freedom from his enslaver for $711, and he comes back to the United States. He delivers this speech. He's 29 years old. He addresses the American Anti-Slavery Society in Manhattan upon his return from the British Isles, which he found to be more accepting and equitable than his own country. And so what he's really talking about is in Europe, he said, I was treated like a man and human being, whereas I have no love for America because it enslaves, you know, people on its blood-drenched soil. And then the third speech, What to the Slave is the 4th of July, I think one of the greatest speeches in American history. He gave it in 1852 at Corinthian Hall in Rochester, New York. He had been invited by the Ladies Anti-Slavery Society to speak about Independence Day. And he wanted nothing to do with Independence Day. And he's really talking in the speech about the hypocrisy of a country that would espouse the ideals of the Founding Fathers and the principles of the Founding Fathers while enslaving people. And he said, you know, what to the slave is your 4th of July? Do you mean to mock me by inviting me to speak today? And he said that this country was guilty of practices that would disgrace a nation of savages at this very hour. And keep in mind, there were 600 people in attendance that day, and these were his friends. They were all anti-slavery people, and he just laid into them. Number four, a proclamation and a Negro army, which was delivered in 1863 during the Civil War, where he's talking about recruiting black soldiers to the Union cause. This is performed by Coleman Domingo, and Douglass would have been about 45 years old when he gave this speech. Another powerful speech, and then the fifth one I mentioned, Lessons of the Hour, delivered in 1893, performed by Jeffrey Wright.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about a new documentary, which will air on Wednesday on HBO. Frederick Douglass in five speeches. My guest tonight is Kenneth B. Morris Jr., a direct descendant of Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington. He's also the founder of the Frederick Douglass Family Initiative. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You spoke about him being the most photographed American of the 19th century. Why do you suppose that is?
He understood from a very young age, really his first photograph, he was about 22 or 23 years old, and only 2 years removed from slavery. And here was a young man who had spent the first 20 years of his life enslaved. He never had a pair of pants or shoes until he was 8 or 9 years old. He would teach himself to read and write over the objections of his overseers, and he would finally escape. And having never spent one day of his life in a classroom, he was a self-taught scholar. He somehow knew that this new technology that he could come of age with, that he could use. He knew that he needed to just kind of shatter that notion in the public consciousness and all of the racist caricatures that were out there that show people of African descent as less than human with exaggerated features. And so at the time, photography, the backgrounds were really kind of ornate and busy. And if you look at Frederick Douglass's photographs, they're simple and the focus is on him. And in some of them, he'll stage the scene. He may have some books on the table or some flowers in the scene, but he knew exactly what he was doing and he was strategic in the way that he went about doing that.
You spoke earlier that after his second speech, the notoriety of it threatened his freedom. It's interesting that he essentially became what we would call today in the parlance of today, a rock star, which
for
a black man during the 1800s, a free black man, that was a dangerous place to be.
You make an excellent point. So that first speech that I mentioned that he delivered in 1841, I've come to tell you something about slavery. He is gaining fame as he's going around from city to city just telling his story. But then he started to have a problem, and that was people started to doubt that he was ever enslaved. They couldn't wrap their minds around what they thought a slave looked and sounded like and what they were seeing and hearing from this eloquent, charismatic, theatrical, funny, well-dressed, good-looking man. And so in order to prove that he was who he claimed to be, that's when he wrote that narrative, that book. And then he had another problem, and that was it became a bestseller, selling 4,500 copies in 3 months. And that's the last thing that you want, is the notoriety of a best-selling book if you're trying to hide from your enslaver. Because at the time, he was what we would have called a fugitive slave. We call those people freedom seekers now, but he was a fugitive slave. And so it was suggested by his supporters that he go to Europe as kind of a cooling off period. And he would go to England and Ireland and to Scotland. And then, as I mentioned, be able to purchase his freedom and then come back to the United States. He would settle in Rochester, New York, begin to publish the North Star newspaper, which was a leading abolitionist voice. And then in 1848, he goes to Seneca Falls and the Women's Rights Convention, and he speaks. He's the only man to speak at that convention, and he's one of 32 men to sign the Declaration of Sentiments that day.
Just yesterday, I was at the Museum of the Bible here in Washington, D.C., and there is an exhibit that focuses on specifically Frederick Douglass and his use of the Bible in his abolitionist work. And it talks about how he uses the contradictions of the Bible as well as using it, the arguments for and against slavery. And there's a lot of discussion about that very thing. I want to talk to you about that after the break. We are talking about Frederick Douglass, a new documentary coming to HBO this Wednesday. Frederick Douglass in five speeches. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're going to take a break, but don't forget you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Inside segment via podcast on WHUR.com. And don't forget you can download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue in just a bit. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. We'll be back in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we're talking about a new documentary, Frederick Douglass in Five Speeches, airing this Wednesday on HBO. My guest is Kenneth B. Morris, Jr., a direct descendant of Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington. He is also the founder of the Frederick Douglass Family Initiative. If you have a comment, if you have a question about the documentary or Frederick Douglass, give us a call at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Right before the break, I was talking about something that I just kind of stumbled upon. I knew I was doing this interview, having this conversation with you, and I just think it was so ironic that I happened to be at the Museum of the Bible. There was a lot of discussion. This was no small treatise about Frederick Douglass. There was a lot of discussion in this exhibit about how he viewed the Bible and Christianity in the complexities of slavery.
Yeah, I think that we really to understand that we need to go back and look at his life as an enslaved boy in Baltimore, Maryland. He had been chosen from among all of the children on the plantation of the Eastern Shore of Maryland, where he had been born into slavery, with the name Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey. He was chosen to go to Baltimore to be the house servant for his master's family. Now, the importance of this move was he was leaving an environment where he wasn't around people that could teach him to read and write, because as we know from our U.S. history, it was illegal to teach an enslaved person to read and write. But now he was going to be in Baltimore. He was going to be around free black children and poor white children. But what happened most importantly when he got there was his mistress had never had a slave before and didn't know that it was illegal to teach him. So she began to teach young Frederick his ABCs, and that was all he needed, was that little spark of light into his mental darkness, into his mental bondage. And those lessons continued for a little while until his enslaver found out. And when he found out, he got angry. And he looked at Frederick and he looked at his wife and he said, "You cannot teach a slave how to read and write, because if you do, it will unfit him to be a slave." And Frederick heard that message loud and clear. And he looked at his master and he thought, if you don't want me to have this, I'm going to do everything in my power to gain it. And he understood right then and there that knowledge is power. So he would continue to teach himself to read and write, and he was very clever in the way that he went about doing that. But eventually, he would purchase with his own money a Bible, begin to read the Bible, and then interact with Reverend Lawson, who was a figure in Baltimore that taught him spirituality. And as Frederick finally escaped, he was very critical of the Christian religion. He did not like the hypocrisy of Christianity being what he called a slave-holding religion. And he made the differentiation pretty early on versus the Christianity of slavery and the pure, peaceable Christianity of Christ. And so as you listen to him and you read his speeches and you read his thousands of articles and his three best-selling autobiographies, there's a theme that comes from the Old Testament in the Bible, and this is why many people refer to him as a prophet. David Blight's book that inspired this HBO documentary is called Prophet of Freedom, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. And so, yes, he was very intentional in the way that he went about, using the Bible and verses to make his point.
One of the things, as I'm listening to you describe him, and I think to the layman, and even to those who only have a cursory understanding of who Frederick Douglass was, and I would argue still is that he very much was the voice of black people, because black people were so voiceless. And because, as we know, he couldn't just read and write. He was an orator. He was, if I may, he provided a sense of poetic justice in his speeches and gave voice to the millions of enslaved Black people whose experiences he could speak to.
He was the mouthpiece for his people. And when he begins to publish the North Star newspaper out of Rochester, New York, he understands that he needs to not only communicate to those people, his brethren that were enslaved, but also to the oppressor, the people that were doing the, that were enslaving people and oppressing over 400 years now. And so it was really important that Frederick Douglass was the one out there because of his gift for writing and communication and his oratory, that he was able to really change the public consciousness and move the country forward. And then, of course, his eventual relationship with Abraham Lincoln and becoming an advisor to him and really pushing Lincoln to the point where he would eventually sign the Emancipation Proclamation, which would free those that were enslaved only in the states that were in rebellion to the Union. It didn't free those that were enslaved in the border states. But we should know from our U.S. history that Abraham Lincoln was very slow to move toward emancipation, and that's why people like Frederick Douglass and the other abolitionists agitating him and pushing him and being critical of him, you know, is a very important piece to the history of our country.
Was he to Abraham Lincoln what Martin Luther King was to Lyndon Baines Johnson?
I think that you could argue that, in fact, he was. They met on at least three occasions that we know of. The third occasion is the one that I like to talk about when I'm in school dialoguing with students, and that was at Lincoln's second inauguration, and Frederick Douglass was there front and center as Lincoln gives his inaugural address, and then after Word Frederick was invited to the, as the kids would call it, the after party at the Executive Mansion. And when he got there, the guards wouldn't let him in. By this time, he had written two best-selling autobiographies. He was, as you said, an A-list celebrity, a rock star. He was known throughout the United States and in many other parts of the world, but none of that mattered. They would not let him in. And when word got back to Lincoln that he was outside, Lincoln said, "Oh, no, let him in." And as they're walking toward each other, and Lincoln was tall, he was probably about 6'4". Frederick Douglass was over 6 feet. And so if you can just imagine the visual of these two giants walking toward each other and towering above the guest, and Abraham Lincoln pointed to Frederick Douglass, and he said, "Here comes my friend, Frederick Douglass. I want to know what you thought about my speech, because there's no person's opinion that I value more than yours." And he called Douglass one of the most meritorious men in America. And Douglass's response was, "That was a sacred effort."
Yeah. And to that point, the visual, for anyone who knows anything about the physicality of men during the 19th century, they were usually very short. They did not, most men did not get above 5'10". And so, as you said, to have these two giants, I think that is a very accurate depiction, and I can imagine just how shocking it would have been, and the impression that it would have made on a crowd in the White House. Indeed, a watershed moment for history in the making. I wanted to ask you a bit about your own, you know, history. When did you find out that, or when did you know that you were a direct descendant of both Douglass and Washington? At what age?
Yeah, that's really a great question. I was born in Washington, D.C., and my parents went to Howard. So shout out to Howard. My grandfather on my father's side was a professor and dean of chemistry at Howard for many, many years.
You know all of this figures, you know that, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think you're a Morgan State man.
Yes, I am. It's okay. Please go right ahead.
Yeah. So, you know, there wasn't a time when someone came to me and said, hey, you know, we need to sit you down. There's something really important that we need to tell you about your family. It's just one of those things that I've always known. I spent all of my summers at Frederick Douglass's summer beach house on the Chesapeake Bay in a place called Highland Beach, Maryland, that was built by my great-great-grandfather, Charles. It was Frederick and Anna Murray Douglass's youngest son, and Charles purchased some acreage on the shores of the bay, and he parceled those out and sold those lots off, but he kept one to build a retirement home for his father. And he asked Frederick, are there any special features that you want in the house? And Frederick said, yes, I want it to point in a certain direction, and I want a tower at the top of the house. And what he wanted to do at the end of his life was to sit up in that tower in retirement and look back across the Chesapeake Bay, because on the other side you can see land, and that land is the eastern shore of Maryland, where he was born into slavery and where he toiled away in chains. And so there were images of my ancestors in every room. And I remember one night, I was probably about 5 years old, and at the top of the stairs there was this larger-than-life portrait of Frederick Douglass with that steely glare that I was talking about. And I didn't understand as a boy, you know, his strategy was behind taking photographs. But I remember looking at that picture and thinking, man, you look mean. And I'm glad I didn't know you. And as I tried to tiptoe past, his eyes would follow me. And by the time I got down to the end of the hallway, I could feel that steely glare burning like fire on the back of my neck. And I always imagined in my little boy imagination this booming baritone voice bellowing down upon me. And he would say, you will do great things, young man. And I felt a lot of pressure. I started to notice that my ancestors were on statues, on money, on postage stamps. There were schools named for them, bridges, libraries. And everywhere I turned, I could feel that kind of long, vast shadow of two of this country's, you know, greatest and influential heroes. So, you know, to answer your question there, I just kind of always knew just because I was born into it and it was around me.
I was about to ask about the pressure and the responsibility. At what age did you feel it? And at any one point, did you have to have a conversation with yourself? And or was there ever a fork in the road in your life where you had to make a decision about the direction in which you were going to go as it related to carrying this family legacy?
My mother, the way the families came together happened on my mom's side of the family. My mother's mother, Nettie Hancock Washington, was Booker T. Washington's granddaughter. And my mother's father, Frederick Douglass III, was Frederick Douglass's great-grandson. They married in 1941. They met at Tuskegee Normal School and Institute, just happened to be on campus the same day, rushing across to get to the other side, literally bumped into each other, didn't know that the other descended from an historic family, and they wound up getting married 3 months later. When my mom was born, Nettie Washington Douglass, she was a person that united the bloodlines, and she was an only child, so I had the honor and privilege of being the first male to carry the dual lineage. And so I did feel that pressure early on, but I think that my parents and my grandparents, great-grandmothers, went in an opposite direction. They weren't going to force anything on me. And so I really grew up decisively disengaged from my lineage until, you know, Providence called in my life. And I was happy to be a father of two daughters, a husband now married for 37 years, a businessman. I own my own advertising and marketing company, and I didn't really want anything to do with this lineage, and I took it for granted. But that fork in the road that you spoke about, all of that changed in 2005 when I read a National Geographic magazine, and the cover story was 21st Century Slaves, and it was about human trafficking and modern-day slavery existing all over the world, including right here in the United States. And I remember one night I was sitting in my living room, and I had started to do a lot of research, and there was another article that I came across about a 12-year-old girl who was forced to be a sex slave in the brothels of Southeast Asia and service countless men almost every single day. And down the hallway, I could hear my daughters getting ready for bed, and my older daughter was 12 and my younger daughter was 9, and my mind just starts racing and I can't wrap my mind around what I'm reading about this 12-year-old girl and what I'm hearing from my daughters. And I thought to myself, that's what young girls and boys should be doing, is getting tucked safely into bed, not being forced into bed to service some sick individual. And when I walked into that room, I had this moment where I couldn't look my girls in the eyes. And all of a sudden, just everything just started welling up inside of me. And I realized that I did have this platform that my ancestors had built through struggle and through sacrifice. And perhaps I could leverage the historical significance of my ancestry to do something about this issue. And so 2 years later, my mom and I started the Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives, and we immediately turned to school. We developed human trafficking prevention education curricula. We've been able to work on trafficking legislation. We have a program in partnership with two California-based nonprofits called PROTECT, and it's online training of educators on how to recognize signs of human trafficking, and they get certified to be able to download age-appropriate curricula to teach in the classroom, K-12 education. And so it's just been this journey. I think because I found this mission on my own and it wasn't forced on me, it's more meaningful.
What do you believe would be Frederick Douglass's mission today in modern in America, other than, of course, being the namesake of D.C. statehood?
Oh, right. D.C. statehood.
Yes, yeah, sure. Exactly.
We're gonna keep working on that, but you know he would be talking about that for sure, right? And speaking truth to power, as he always did. You know, unfortunately, when we read his words, they are still as relevant today to the challenges that we face. And I think that if he were here today, I believe that he would be somewhat pleased that we have made some progress. We elected an African-American president. We've got our first female vice president of color. He would be happy with that progress, but I also believe that he would be outraged to see that there's still so much work that needs to be done. You know, we're living at a time when we're as divided as a country as we've been in a very, very long time. And with the hateful, racist, xenophobic, sexist rhetoric that's out there, he would be still speaking truth to power. He would be, as he said, agitating. And, you know, so that's something that we continue at our organization, lifting up the life and legacies of my ancestors, Frederick Douglass, Booker T. Washington, Olivia Davidson, who was married to Booker T. Washington, and my great-great-great-grandmother, Anna Murray Douglass, who was married to Frederick for 44 years. They had 5 children together and 21 grandchildren, and she was a radical freedom fighter in her own right. In fact, the whole Douglass family was a radical freedom-fighting collective, and so we spend a lot of time teaching young people about that to inspire them to believe that they can do and be anything possible. And this idea that we all descend from greatness. We all may not descend from somebody that has the notoriety that my ancestors do, but each and every one of us stands on the shoulders and walks in the shoes of those that came before us. And some of our ancestors may have given up their lives just for the freedoms that we do have, may have given up their lives just so that we have an opportunity to even sit in a classroom to get an education. I remember I had a 10-year-old girl say to me one time when we just started out, and I'll never forget this. She raised her hand, and she was bouncing up and down in her chair, and she said, Mr. Morris, I researched my family tree, and I found that my great-great-great-great-four-greats grandmother was born into slavery, taught herself to read and write in secret, ran away, and became a successful businesswoman and a philanthropist, and she knew exactly what that word meant, and she was proud of it. And she said, so Mr. Morris, do you know what all of this means? And before I had a chance to answer, she said, it means I have greatness flowing through my veins just like you do. And that's it. History lives in each of us. But the future depends on how we carry that history forward.
I would also argue that for all that he did, his greatest accomplishment was what he did with self-educating, and yet he lived long enough to see the beginnings of higher education for people of color, the likes of a Howard University, the likes of a Morgan State University, and so many others. And I can only imagine what those kinds of institutions just beginning in his lifetime meant to him.
He was very proud because that was the result of the hard work that he had put in and many others. And so, you know, as I mentioned, he never spent a day of his life in a classroom. He was a self-taught scholar, but here's a man that became the first African-American nominated for Vice President of the United States, the first African-American U.S. Marshal, first African-American Ambassador and Consul General to Haiti, first African-American Recorder of Deeds in the District of Columbia, and the first African-American to have a statue dedicated in his honor. And that list goes on and on and on. And people would ask him on occasion, Frederick, I need to know, where did you go to school? Where did you get your education? And he would respond on occasion by saying, my degree is written on my back. Mm-hmm. And of course, he's talking about the 20 years that he spent enslaved in his life and the brutality that he suffered and survived. And so you could only imagine that he would have been very proud to see these institutions. Also, he was very proud of his family. He only saw his mother four times his whole life because she lived on a plantation that was 12 miles away. He didn't know his father. It was presumed that his father was his enslaver. He had brothers and sisters that he'd been separated from. They were like strangers to him. And so he was an orphan with no home, no family, and no country. But yet, in spite of all of that, through education, he was able to rise up and to go on to affect change for all of us today. So if you can imagine, when he's in Cedar Hill in the Anacostia neighborhood of Washington, D.C., in that big house with 21 grandchildren running around, how much he would have loved spending time with his family. And so we're very proud to tell that story as well, because that's not something that scholars typically focus on.
What do you want people to come away with after they've had an opportunity to view this documentary? Because we know that this is about speeches, but I've not seen it. And so I cannot say, I do not know how much it delves into some of the parts that we have discussed.
The audience will learn about his life story through these five speeches. What I hope people will take away is inspiration and understanding that we can affect change in the world around us, and in doing so, affect change for future generations. What will our great-great-great-grandchildren say about us 150 years from now in this moment in time when we're facing all of, you know, the challenges and obstacles that I mentioned earlier, and voting rights and everything that is happening in this country? I hope that people will be inspired to know that he lifted his voice, and here we are 150 plus years later still talking about his contributions. And that should be inspiration to all of us, that we can affect change in the world around us, and that change will ripple throughout the generations and throughout history.
Lisa from Fairfax, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, yes. Hi, Harold. Hi, Mr. Morrison. I'm just want to say I'm embarrassed because I don't know what questions to ask of this great man that I know of our history. I just want to say thank you to Mr. Douglas and Mr. Morrison. I think it's totally awesome that you have a double lineage. It's an honor to speak with you. I've enjoyed the stories that you shared. And I'm definitely going to watch the documentary and learn. And you're absolutely correct. He is an inspiration. I'm going to learn more about him. So I just wanted to let you know that I am listening, and just to say thank you. And I have a picture of a great-grandfather what my grandmother does, and I know about those eyes following you in the picture.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Lisa. I really appreciate your comments and the call. And you made me think about, you kind of pushed me back into my childhood a little bit, because I would have people of all ages come up to me many times with tears in their eyes, and they'd want to, you know, pinch my cheeks or give me a hug. And I never understood why there was such an emotional connection to my ancestors. And I really felt like I hadn't done anything to be worthy of that kind of response. And it wasn't until I started doing this work and a woman came up to me and she had tears in her eyes. And she said, I read Frederick Douglass's autobiography when I was in the eighth grade. I read Booker T. Washington's Up from Slavery when I was in college. And those books inspired me and made me believe that I could do and be anything possible. And I'm the person that I am today. I'm the leader that I am today at my corporation because of the inspiration they provided. So can I give you a hug because you're a conduit to saying thank you to your ancestors? And so I definitely have a better perspective on that. And I never get tired of hearing what you just talked about. So I thank you very much.
You're welcome, and thank you for carrying on and doing the things that you're doing to educate the young children, and just thank you so much. Thank you, and again, it's an honor to speak with you.
Lisa, thank you so much for your phone call. And I think, you know, one of the things that I think will come out of this conversation, you know, for me, and there's so much, but maybe it's time to take a little drive down to Highland Beach.
Oh, yes. I was just there 2 days ago. I was in town celebrating Frederick Douglass's birthday with our second annual Douglass Week, which is in partnership with the Embassy of Ireland. And we talk about Douglass's time in Ireland and how he is still so revered there. And we did a program on the 14th at Arena Stage, which for a live audience, and it was just a fantastic evening. And so I took a trip out to Highland Beach and then got myself some crabs on the other side of the Bay Bridge, and then headed back home to California.
What's next for you in the projects that are your family?
We have a lot going on. I'm working on some media projects, developing a limited television series about Frederick Douglass. I'm also working on a feature film, which I promise to come back and talk about if you'll have me on, but it's got an outstanding cast and it's going to just be an incredible biopic on Frederick Douglass. We're also partnering with the History Channel and working on a project called 1 Million Abolitionists. We've republished Frederick Douglass's first autobiography, the narrative that I've been talking about, and we're working to give away 1 million copies of that book to young people everywhere. We just sent, I think it was about 1,000 copies to Ireland for the students over there that are going to be working on Frederick Douglass curricula. So it's an international program, and we're very proud to partner with the History Channel on that. We're based in Rochester, New York. We're doing some work around racial equity there and working with partners. We just have so much going on, and I just am so proud to know that my ancestors, their stories and their lives and their legacies still resonate with people today. You know, Frederick Douglass said it's easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. And Booker T. Washington said, if you want to lift up yourself, lift up someone else. And so we are focused at Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives on building strong children and helping them to do service projects in their communities to lift up someone else.
Mm-hmm. No longer a burden, but now certainly continuing to carry the mantle of the legacy of Douglass and Washington. Kenneth B. Morris, Jr., thank you so much for sharing with us tonight. It has been a really educational conversation.
Thank you for having me on. I've enjoyed the conversation. I appreciate it.
That is the Daily Drum for this Monday, February 21st. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.